Hello, welcome to 8.9 Newsweek. I'm Finlow Costain. As regular listeners will know, Newsweek tends to be a collection of the audio from our recent 8.9 TV interviews. If you want to watch instead of listen, then you can visit the 8.9.com website and click on the TV tab. Well, today we have a bumper programme with five interviews covering everything from the natural capital markets available to farmers to the fact that climate change is happening faster than predicted in Scotland. We'll hear from the Food Ethics Council about their proposals for UK dairy, and from the head of the RSPB's Fair to Nature, and from a farmer who successfully introduced hemp as a break crop. Let's start with those natural capital markets. The Green Finance Institute has published an excellent free interactive farming toolkit commissioned by DEFRA to equip and empower the farming community to understand nature markets, such as carbon credits and biodiversity net gain, and to help them assess whether they could provide a suitable new income stream for their businesses. Helen Avery is the Director of Nature Programmes and GFI Hive at the Green Finance Institute, and I asked her what the key benefits are for farmers wanting to enter the nature market.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not for everyone. I think we're quite clear about that in the toolkit. We're not advising people that nature markets are for every single farmer, rather trying to help them think about, is it right for them? But the obvious opportunity is that it can provide an additional complementary income stream to subsidies. So, for example, you might be able to, you know, as we know, be able to sell biodiversity units. You might be able to sell voluntary carbon credits. You might be able to make some changes to your nutrient intake and therefore be able to act through a nutrient neutrality scheme and receive monies that way. So that's really the main benefit. Otherwise, you know, why would you do it as a farmer? And the additional benefit is, of course, that you're then improving the environmental state of your farm, which then ultimately feeds into the UK's targets for net zero and our 25-year environment plan for England and our other nature positive targets. But I would say the primary reason that a farmer would do it is because it's an additional source of income.
You mentioned one or two of those nature markets there, but I wonder if you could just outline them in slightly more detail.
So we have, across the UK, we have woodland carbon market and a peatland carbon market, where you can sell, obviously, improvements to peatland restoration. And if you're planting woodland, you'll be able to sell the credits that come from the reduced carbon, the carbon sink, rather. And biodiversity net gain is not in effect yet. That's just for England. But that is coming in, we're told, in the next month or so, or within the next month. And that will be improvements in biodiversity can be sold to property developers in particular, who have to have a 10% net gain of any biodiversity that is obviously destroyed through their property development is produced on site or off site. And that can vary by council. And obviously it's dependent on, is there a demand for local homes in your area in England? If so, then as a farmer, you might be able to tap into that market. And then nutrient neutrality, again, it's very dependent on property development. So you might be in a region where they're trying to reduce some of the nutrients flowing into the waterways. So in that case, you would be making changes to your inputs and then selling essentially them as offsets back into those schemes. So they are the majority of what we're seeing. There are also other projects that you can take part in, such as reducing flood risk in your area by making interventions such as re-wiggling rivers, introducing wetlands, planting trees. And in some cases, we've seen projects that have been able to sell that reduced risk to buyers. So that's another alternative at the moment to some of those other markets. There are other carbon markets being developed, and there's a biodiversity voluntary credit market also in development, but they're very new. And then finally, the one everyone gets very excited about is soil carbon. And again, that's very nascent in the UK, but is in existence.
Some of those markets are more formalised than others, aren't they? So, for example, biodiversity net gain has quite strict rules, whereas the water market projects might develop more informally.
Yeah, absolutely. They have, I think that they're all very different. The government by different standards. We do have under development the nature market standards that's being developed by the British Standards Institution that will aim to ensure that all nature markets are kept to the same rigorous amount of rules and governance around them. But yes, they are all very different.
Now, a lot is changing for farmers at the moment, and starting out in the nature market could seem pretty daunting. Your toolkit's a great starting point, but would you recommend that farmers starting down this road sell direct or go through land agents?
So I think there are actually probably more options than those. For example, you might want to work with your neighbouring farmers and develop a farmer cluster. There are examples of some aggregated models where farmers have come together and sold collectively. And yes, you could sell through land agents, you could sell through other third-party brokers or direct. It's different for everyone, which I know is not helpful all the time to keep hearing in every situation it's going to be different. I would think that from the experience we've seen of farmers, if you are a very large estate, or perhaps if you've come together as a large collective, so you're over a larger landscape, you're probably more able to sell direct because you'll be selling directly to one buyer. You'll be able to meet their demand. If you are, however, smaller, then yes, you're probably going to be starting to be approached by third-party brokers. And even if you're bigger, you'll be approached by third-party brokers. That's another option. And we lay out quite clearly in the toolkit the questions you're going to want to ask back to anyone who approaches you with a what seems to be a very good offer. If you don't feel comfortable and you have a good relationship with a land agent, of course you would work with your land agent in the same way that, you know, I have people who work on my house who I trust to do a much better job than I would. And so I would use them. So it really does depend. But I think unless you're, say, a small farm that happens to know a local business that wants a small amount of carbon credits, for example, when you work and you have a close relationship with them where you would sell direct, in most cases, the direct sales would be on a large landscape scale.
As you've mentioned, there's lots of information in the toolkit, but one barrier to entry is surely the length of a nature market agreement and liability, particularly liability further down the track as new science develops and policy priorities change. Do you think that early entrance to the nature market will be at a disadvantage because prices and agreements may be less favourable than when the market has been further developed and has settled down a bit?
I love this question because I think you could go either way, couldn't you? You could say that if you're a first mover, you might actually have the opportunity to earn more money than down the line. I think that will depend. We would expect that carbon prices will increase over time before ultimately decreasing just due to demand. So I know that the carbon price isn't attractive enough at the moment for some farmers to start planting woodlands and making commitments for 20, 25 years. That makes total sense. But in other cases, so for example, nutrient neutrality, it's probably good to move now. And perhaps in some case, you could argue that for BNG, biodiversity net gain, because there is only ultimately an amount of houses that are going to go into development. And so if you're the one who's there saying, here is my habitat bank, or here's the project that I'm going to do, then you're likely to be an advantage. I think some of the challenges come in is if people do say, well, what if prices go up, or what if the contracts change, or what if government policy changes? And I think all that's fair. And I think it's creating a lot of uncertainty. And therefore, I understand if people say, let's just take stock and see what we want to do, especially when some of these are 30-year contracts. In the case of BNG, different in soil carbon, they're one-year low, short-term contracts. So our advice is just, you know, take as long as you want. If you're sitting tight for a couple of years, it's not going to be a problem. We're not going to see major moves in prices. BNG is an established statutory, like, regulated market. So that's probably something you do want to have a look at now as it's coming into effect. And the same with those other compliance markets. And then just think about in the voluntary carbon markets, because they are very long term, is it right for you? But there's no harm in sort of getting going now, certainly on baselining.
Are there nature market opportunities for tenant farmers, or is this really something that's much more for farmer landowners?
There are. We've seen some sales of tenant farmers. It's few and far between at the moment, just because it's still not quite sure what that relationship should be in terms of splitting the risk, splitting the maintenance costs over a period long period of time. Obviously, if you're a farmer with a tenancy of 5 years, woodland creation is unlikely to work for you. That said, if your landlord has a plan for a whole swathe of tenancies to create woodland, I know that can seem quite terrifying, but hopefully on unproductive land, perhaps, then there might be an opportunity for some revenue, income sharing, in addition to the maintenance. You might get paid for the maintenance. What we have seen is that there are some, environmental farmers group, that's a natural capital cooperative. There are tenancies within that. that are benefiting from being part of the group but aren't actually selling something themselves. And then we're hearing from landlords that they're kind of testing the waters on their own pieces of unproductive land before then broaching with their tenants, this is something I'd like to do. Are you up for it? So our advice, and it's not really particularly groundbreaking advice, is go through your own tenancy agreements, understand what your liabilities are in terms of, you know, is the data you might collect if you baseline yours? Actually, does it belong to your landlord? Have a discussion with your landlord about what they're thinking and then sort of go from there. So again, it's one of those not very solid answer, but there are ways through for sure.
As I said, the toolkit is fantastic, but is it static now, or will it develop more in due course?
Yes, it will have to develop more because things are changing so fast all the time. And I mean, the main thing we'll be doing is just again checking with farmers out there their feedback on, is it usable, is the content right for you, is the content right, updating every time there's a policy update. But really we're looking for case studies, because I think we all, as humans, really learn from seeing what our peers are doing. And that's exactly the same for farmers. So at the moment, there are few and far between these case studies that we can put out there to show successful trades, because it's still so nascent and some of these markets aren't even up and running yet. So we'll be adding much more case studies as they come on, which I think will be helpful, and more resources. So no, it won't be static. We'll still be working on it for sure.
That was Helen Avery from the Green Finance Institute. Let's stick with farming, but turn to dairy. A new report from the Food Ethics Council says that a whole sector approach is necessary to transition UK dairy toward a resilient, fair and fit for purpose future. Abby Williams is the dairy project lead at the Food Ethics Council. I asked her what she means by a whole sector approach and how this can help to deliver resilience.
So I guess firstly I'll talk about what we mean by resilience. So I think it's important to say, when we're talking about the need to create resilience in UK dairy, we're not talking about a way to find ways to keep things the way they are. We don't want to keep things the way they are, essentially. We know that many on-farm practices and dairy systems need to change to work better for people, animals and nature. But resilience is actually also about creating an attractive sector for future generations. So really, we should be asking what's important to young people, both for young people that want to work in the farming sector, but also for young people that want to consume dairy in the future. So for everyone, really. We know that lots of young people are interested in agroecology, they're interested in socially just systems and have values that align with protecting ecosystems. And actually, dairy is really well placed to embrace this young energy. We know that despite what some media outlets may suggest, there is actually an appetite for positive change amongst many farmers. And some farmers are actually already making some incredible shifts in their farming businesses despite difficult circumstances. But we need to recognise that there are lots of farmers that are locked into systems that they feel are out of their control. And farmers can't do this all on their own. They need support from across the sector if we want to accelerate a transition.
Which brings us to the whole sector. So what do we mean by whole sector?
So I suppose when we talk about whole sector, it's recognising the complex financial and social systems that farmers are operating within. So yes, whole sector approach, it helps us to identify where power lies. We feel that we all have a role to play, but particularly processors and retailers hold a lot of power when it comes to making change in the dairy sector. And we think without the sort of larger sort of whole sector approach and more systemic change, we risk actually just tinkering around the edges a little bit.
One of the key actions that the report calls for is the end of the sale of milk as a loss leader. What difference would that make, and what do retailers make of this suggestion?
So the price of milk is always a contentious issue, particularly at the moment when sort of households and supermarkets are trying to keep the shopping basket price down. But I mean, loss leaders in general distort the reality of what things cost, and milk has been particularly and unfairly squeezed over the years. So as well as distorting the true cost of producing milk, artificially low pricing has arguably contributed to further sort of disconnect between the public and food and farming production. There's clearly a lot of work to be done in reconnecting the public with food, and loss leaders don't go any way to mending this. If retailers can commit to ending the sale of milk as a loss leader, not only would it hopefully give a little bit more wiggle room financially to pay people more fairly across the whole dairy value chain, But it's also a first step in highlighting the true cost of milk to the public. In terms of their thoughts on this, we are holding a dairy summit, sort of a future dairy summit next week. So we'll find out in a little bit more detail, hopefully from retailers, what they think. But anecdotally, we know a couple of them are very interested in this idea, but they're, I suppose, they're understandably reluctant to talk publicly about it, sort of due to competition reasons. But there's hope there.
Retailers often say in these circumstances that they'd like to make the change, but that they don't want to be at a competitive disadvantage. Is there a need for the government to step in here?
Yeah, I mean, so we've kind of seen this a little bit in terms of milk contracts with processors and dairy farmers. So there's a voluntary code of conduct at the moment to try and regulate those relationships between farmers and processors. Doesn't talk about milk prices, but it talks about the relationships they have. And there are a number of processors that have signed up for that. However, we've heard from them that it's often been a sort of a disadvantage to them. And really, they want this sort of policy to come in from government. And the exact same thing would be relevant for government coming in and kind of regulating this space. And we've not done loads of work on loss leaders and the role that government can play in that, but there's definitely sort of parallels there with the dairy code of conduct and processors and also retailers' role as well.
The other action that I'm particularly interested in is the call to create secure, fair and flexible contracts. Why is this important?
Yeah, when we spoke with farmers for the past few years, one of the things that came up a lot in terms of their inability to make changes or the things that they were struggling with to make changes on the farm was these really sort of restrictive and unfair contracts that they had with processors. And despite all the aspiration in the world, some farmers just felt that they couldn't even begin to start that journey of a transition to something better, whatever that meant to them. I mean, there's loads that comes in as well around bad practice from processors in terms of not giving farmers very much time to read or sign contracts. But beyond sort of the inflexibility of them, there's also just this big power imbalance. So there's not many milk contracts going around. So if you're lucky enough to be able to get a milk contract as a farmer, there is a power imbalance there where retailers or processors, whoever you're signing with, often kind of call the shots, and they often feel that they kind of just have to go along with it. And often built in is things like exclusivity. And so we heard farmers that wanted to sell locally just small amounts of milk, particularly during the pandemic when there was kind of resurgence of local food, and they weren't able to do that, and often were actually having to throw milk away down the drain rather than be able to sell locally, which seems ridiculous. So there's things there around flexibility, just being pragmatic, but also retailers and processors being open to farmers coming in, having conversations around being able to change contracts as well. It seems that there's actually just a lot of miscommunication between processors and farmers, and that's due to years of sort of bad practice, mistrust, poor relationships. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, something like a dairy code of conduct will go a massive way into improving these, particularly around flexibility and exclusivity.
Now, the dairy industry has industrialised quite recently and extremely rapidly. What are the main ethical challenges that you would associate with this industrialisation?
In a nutshell, there's been a bit of a race to the bottom in dairy. So, as you implied, this comes with a whole raft of ethical tensions and challenges. And we find ourselves actually in a situation where many farmers don't see any other option other than to increase their herd size and efficiency if they want to continue being a profitable business. And this has been a trend for some years now. And although you could argue that there's lots of great stuff that has come out of having more efficient dairy systems, there are also some ethical challenges with that, particularly around animal welfare. How much should we be pushing these animals? Is it fair to be for them to be producing as much milk as they are in some instances? Is it right that we have fully housed systems? I don't have an answer. There's not a straightforward answer. But this is these are the tensions and challenges that have come along with these sort of more industrialized system, with essentially dairy farmers being pushed onto this treadmill of volume-based production over anything else. Another, if I have time, another sort of key ethical issue that we found that is often kind of overlooked in these dairy systems is the people element. So farmers and farm workers and the impact of these systems on them is often forgotten about. But actually, we're operating dairy systems now where dairy farmers are incredibly overworked, they're stressed, They're underpaid. They don't have time to get off the farm and engage in peer-to-peer learning or knowledge exchange, many of which are available. And then, yeah, we're expecting them to make all these changes on the farm, whereas there's not even enough hours in the day for them to be able to milk enough cows to be able to even just run a profitable business. So I think that people element and the impact it has on farmers themselves is really important as well.
Abby Williams from the Food Ethics Council. Hemp is an important fibre crop that's becoming increasingly popular with farmers, including Christy York from the Hutton Wansley estate in the Vale of York. I asked Christy what attracted him to hemp in the first place.
I think it was really a diversification play for us. We grow a range of different cereal crops and have a big potato operation as well. But the opportunity to grow something that would immediately go to a local producer and was particularly low input for us was very attractive.
So essentially it's a break crop for you, is it?
It's a break crop. It's a great rotation crop for us. Both the hemp plant has a very long taproot. It's a very low input as far as herbicides, pesticides, fungicides are concerned. So it just made a lot of sense for us. I think from a fitting into the harvest or the agricultural year, yeah, we typically drill it after most of our spring work has been done already. So that'll be sort of mid May. It has a very fast growth cycle, so that you are harvesting it within 4 months, and really we have very little to do to the crop, to do to the plant in that time, and it will grow from nothing to 8 to 12 feet within 4 months.
How does hemp fit into your business structure?
It's really just the honest answer is it doesn't naturally, but I'm pretty relaxed about that. It was the opportunity to, as I said, to have a different rotational crop. We grow vining peas, which again would fit into that category. That is more of a sort of nitrogen fixer for us. But hemp is really just a low input rotational crop that can grow. It likes lighter, sandier soil, and the farm here is split between lighter, sandier stuff, which is good for root crops, and slightly heavier clay-based soil, which is for everything else. But it's quite happily grown. We've tried it on both soil structures, and it's whilst it prefers the lighter soil, it grows very, very happily on the heavier stuff.
How big is your farm overall, and how much does the hemp take of it?
So the farm in total is just under 3,000 acres. We've got about 2,000 under the plough, as it were, and the hemp will be no more than 50, 60 acres a time. This 2024 will be our fourth year of harvesting or drilling the crop. And so it is rotated now, I guess, over about 200 acres, or will do about 200 acres of the farm in total.
Now, you mentioned that this is going to a local supplier. So what actually happens to it?
So the local supplier is a sort of high-end mattress manufacturer who initially were using the hemp fibers purely for mattress filling. Mm-hmm. However, they've developed their technology to the extent that pretty much the entire mattress construction, both outer, inner, headboard, and anything to do with the mattress itself is produced from a hemp byproduct. They are 10 miles down the road, are fantastic in terms of advice, and were the sort of guys that we were able to talk to initially about whether or not it was a good option for us.
Now, you've talked about one or two of the business advantages of hemp, its use as a break crop, for example. Are there also environmental benefits?
Yeah, I mean, the low input side, as I've talked about, with so we typically put nothing on it. It's drilled, providing we have some rain, which has not been an issue for us in the last few years. It does struggle in very dry conditions, but we've been lucky that we've had wet springs and summers. No herbicides, no pesticides, no fungicides. The cover itself that the plant produces as it gets to maturity is huge. There are no natural predators for the plant itself, And it's a bit of a haven, I guess, for wildlife as well. I think for every ton of hemp that is produced, it sequesters 1.6 tons of carbon dioxide as well, which is a beneficial sort of byproduct of what we're doing.
Hemp is a notoriously strong fiber. So are there challenges with harvesting it?
Yes, thankfully, although we will drill it and ted it and bale it, we're not harvesting it, thank heavens. We have a contractor that comes in with a terrifying piece of equipment, which is three rear-mounted blades on a tractor, typically at sort of knee, chest and head height, to take a 12-foot plant down, and we'll cut it in three lengths. That fiber is incredibly tough when it is first harvested. It will then ret for about 6 weeks on the ground to let the leaves fall off, so you're just left with the actual stalk itself. As I said, we will ted that once and then row it up and then bale it probably sort of September time, by which stage, although it is still pretty fibrous and pretty tough, it's a lot more manageable than it was when it was first harvested.
Christy, you talk about a contractor there with specialist equipment, and then, of course, the hemp is going to the mattress producer. So is there quite a cluster of farmers producing hemp in the York area? I'm guessing that you're not the only one feeding into that supply chain.
No, indeed. And I was very keen to take soundings from local growers before we embarked on this. Yes, there are a number in Yorkshire and East Yorkshire particularly who are growing it, and that kind of information transfer is pretty useful for us.
What advice would you give to farmers who are just starting to think about producing hemp?
I think the most challenging aspect is nothing to do with actually growing the crop. It's dealing with the Home Office and dealing with licensing, which is a pain, quite frankly. It's reasonably expensive. It's quite time intensive. And that is, I would guess, the thing that one needs to look into before one commits to growing this crop. Once that's done, I think identifying a market for your product in the same way that you would market any agricultural product, and look at how it fits into your crop rotation on the farm particularly. For us, that's been relatively easy, but for others, it might be more challenging.
What is it that concerns the Home Office? What information do they require?
Well, it's anything. I think they are terrified of anything with which contains even minute quantities of THC. We're obviously not growing this for flowers or seeds. We are purely growing it for the fiber, but you seem to have to jump through similar sized hoops whether you wish to grow for oil or whether you're just simply growing for fiber. I imagine that will, in time, get better, and farmers' or growers' experiences will improve, but at the moment it's still relatively challenging.
That was Christy York from the Hutton Wansley Estate. A new report, Without Nature, There Is No Food, from the RSPB's Fair to Nature certification scheme, has found that over half of adults want UK farmers to adopt farming practices which preserve and enhance the environment and nature. Mark Varney is the head of Fair to Nature. I asked him about the scheme and about where we might expect to find the label.
Fair to Nature, RSPB Fair to Nature, is a certification scheme that restores and protects biodiversity on UK farms. We've been established since the mid-late 80s, originally as conservation grade, and the RSPB has run the scheme since 2017. We have a standard that's pretty unique in the sense it covers a wide range of sustainability standards. What's unique about it is we have a requirement that farms cover 10% of the farmed area in quality habitats for nature. And that, you know, scientifically shows that that restores and protects biodiversity. We have advisors who support farmers on implementing the standard. It's a specific standard, but not prescriptive, and it gives different choices for farmers that works for them. And we've got a logo, the Fair to Nature logo, which incorporates the RSPB logo. And that's really important because the RSPB logo is known and trusted by people.
What sort of products would I find the Fair to Nature label on? Because it's not one that I see frequently in supermarkets.
Well, we launched the scheme last year with the new logo, and we're very much in the growth stage at the moment. We launched products with a fantastic meat company, Farm Wilder, early in December, and prior to that with Summerdown Mint Tea, and I'm in extensive conversations with dairy companies, milk companies, cheese companies, a few cider businesses. So the goal is by the middle of next year to that, you know, the people in their shops will be able to buy milk and bread and cheese, oats, cereals, you know, ciders, possibly some wine, a range of commodities, hopefully some produce as well, some fruit and vegetable. So a wide range of commodities that we can source from the UK. In a snapshot, that what we're really trying to do is to replicate what the fair trade movement achieved for growers and workers in the global south for UK wildlife on farms, getting shoppers to care and think about wildlife when they buy their food, and then link that purchase to changes that are happening on farm.
So one to look out for in the future. One of the headlines from your report was that 56% of adults want UK farmers to adopt farming practices which preserve and enhance the environment and nature. Were you surprised that that figure was so low?
We have stats that suggest that as much as nearly 80% are concerned about biodiversity loss. The 56% was in response to a question where we asked what they wanted farmers to prioritize. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting because 56% said preserving, enhancing nature and wildlife, as opposed to 35% said reduction of greenhouse gases. Mm. Preserving a natural water system was just behind biodiversity. And what we think that is that people understand, they can understand and relate to the butterflies, the birds, the bees, the beautiful wildflowers that they may have experienced in the countryside, in the incredible UK farms that we've got. It's a really important issue for people around the country, for shoppers, for our farmers and consumers. But the food industry has probably responded a little bit too much around climate and supporting farmers to try and address climate change, but not really addressing what are dual crises in nature, biodiversity loss crisis, nature crisis, and a climate crisis.
That would indicate that there's work to do to help the public to recognise that the nature crisis is connected, and that climate and climate mitigation in particular is just one part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. The great news is that a lot of the interventions that farmers are already starting to do, many are doing, that are positive for climate mitigation are actually brilliant for wildlife too. So you think about effective hedgerow management, you know, putting borders around fields, you know, moving away from simple ryegrass to multi-species herbal leys. All of those things are great for storing carbon, or you know, for herbal leys, reducing reliance on artificial fertilizers. And actually, a lot of those things are also very good for climate change adaptation. We've got some fantastic farming partners who are incorporating agroforestry into their programs, and that's both good for wildlife, but it also helps mitigate climate change in terms of sequestration and supports adaptation in terms of preventing runoff. You know, the some of the dairy farmers I've talked to have said they got that because they want to provide shelter for their cattle as we get, you know, hotter summers. So yes, there's a great overlap between climate and nature, but we do need people to understand that about the biodiversity and crisis that exists. We've lost 50% of our hedgerows, 50% of our farmland birds, 64% of our flying insects since the war. So there is a serious issue, but that's not down to farmers. And I say that as a non-farmer, but I work with a lot of farmers. That's down to the policies that we've put in place as a society and the expectations we've got around sort of cheap food, and farmers have responded.
Now, clearly, many of the farmers that you're working with are working to deliver multiple outcomes across their entire farm. But one of the concerns I had with the report was the statement, and you referred to this already, that nature could be protected and restored if all farmers made 10% of their land available for nature. So the question is, what happens to the other 90%? Because as discussed, to address the nature crisis, we need all farming and food production to be on a multi-outcome agroecological basis.
Well, in effect, that's what the 10% habitats means. It's quality habitats incorporated within a farm. So that can include things like wildflower strips around farms. It can obviously include effective hedgerow management, water features. Often that includes within field plots, but you know, bird plots, lapwing plots that are kept fallow. Our farm on our Hope Farm, which is an RSPB farm, we have some sacrificial crops within an arable to actually encourage some of the beneficial insects which are great for birds, but also prevent the reduce the requirement to use pesticides. So I would say, you know, we're encouraging more farms to be agroecological in their approach by incorporating that 10%. Now, a couple of farmers have talked to me. This is farmers talking to me about thinking about the whole farm as a factory. And you've got the production facility, which is the machinery in the center of the field, but you need the water and the electricity and the plumbing. And that's what the borders and the wildflower strips and the water features are doing. It's providing the support services to farm productively. And that's what farmers have said to me. And I think it's that what we're trying to get to society, get people to understand, hence the title of the report, is without nature, there is no food. And a lot of those habitats support the pollinators that are essential for our berries, for our apples, for our pears, for our cider, for our wine. And the beneficial insects, you know, use those habitats as well.
I take the point about 10% of specific habitat creation, but many farmers would say that the most important habitat on any farm is the soil, that is the building block of biodiversity, and that without it fully cycling nutrients and water, you won't get the benefits cascading upwards and outwards across the rest of the farm. So the focus on 10% surely implies that we can carry on with business as usual elsewhere.
Effective soil management is an important part of the standard. I suppose part of the reason that we focus on the habitat is that that's what we're bringing as a, you know, the largest wildlife charity in Europe with, you know, over 130 years of experience of advising, you know, on habitats and supporting wildlife. That's our expertise. And the science says that that is necessary as well as effective soil management. I think the other thing is that there is science to support the fact if farmers don't want to go down a regenerative soil management approach, they want to carry on, you know, maybe ploughing, and then having good habitats around the farm will provide, you know, important for wildlife to thrive. So I think what we're trying to do with nature, with Fair to Nature, is make a program that's available for a whole scope of farmers, small, large, organic, conventional, regenerative. If they put those habitats in place, it's positive for nature. But yeah, you're right, having the good, effective soil management is critical.
In the report, there's recognition that customers don't always know the difference between terms like regenerative or nature-friendly farming. But often the bigger challenge is that it's hard to find a nature-friendly product at all in particular product ranges. Which food sectors do you think present the biggest challenge for customers?
Well, I think you're right. There's not an awful lot of nature-friendly products out there, and it's absolutely our mission to change that, as I say. I mean, I wouldn't pick up on any one particular category. I think, you know, our goal is that we dramatically increase the amount of nature-friendly products that are available for shoppers.
And just finally, are there any other key findings from the report that you'd like to share?
Yeah, we go into some detail about what the importance to customers, to shoppers. There's further detail about the scale of risk, actually. And we've got to be careful about, you know, using too much inflammatory language, but, you know, I've talked to the scientists at RSPB, and so let's put some numbers on how big an issue loss of biodiversity is to us in farming. And they say to me, it's a very, very complex issue. You know, we can't just have a simple linear. We're going to, for example, in climate change, we're on a 4-degree trajectory, and we need to get a 1.5-degree trajectory. And there's some interesting quotes from people from, you know, the CEO of Tesco and chairman of John Lewis, who are highlighting this is a risk that we need to think about. And actually, probably our recommendation in the report is take a bit more of a precautionary principle. The thing I would mention is, and this is very much an English UK government focus, that the agricultural transition plan the government announced a couple of years ago, there are some gaps in terms of an overall plan, but there is increased funding available for farmers to put in things like the wildflower strips and leaving some parts of the fields fallow, and that is really, really positive for wildlife. But it's also increased funding available for farmers. And the UK government have made an intention to get to 500,000 hectares of habitat managed well of land managed well for nature, which we think is a good target.
Mark Varney from Fair to Nature.
Scotland's climate is changing faster than scientists predicted, with an increasing likelihood of more frequent and more extreme weather events, according to a new analysis by the James Hutton Institute. I spoke to Dr. Mike Rivington, who led the research for the Scottish Government, and I asked him to outline the key findings from the report.
Well, the main thing, you know, was that what we've found was that climate change has already happened to some considerable amount, particularly winter rainfall. Winter rainfall from sort of December, January, February has already increased more than what climate projections were forecasting out to 2050. And that was quite a surprise. We knew that some changes had happened, but actually seeing it in sort of graphical form was quite a surprise. But the other thing was that we found that particularly February temperatures have already increased in the order of about 2 degrees, which puts them at the sort of bottom end of what the climate projections were showing for 2050. So really what it tells me is that what we've already experienced is pretty much on track, even a bit faster than what some of the climate projections have been forecasting through to sort of mid-century.
It almost sounds as though climate change is accelerating faster than expected if we're already starting to see low-end 2050 projections reached today in 2024.
Yeah, it's difficult to know whether climate change is accelerating faster than expected. We all, from climate science, we've known for decades that it will accelerate, but at what rate is difficult to tell. I think our analysis sort of confirms that yes, it is happening and happening fairly quickly. Whether it will continue to accelerate, that will depend on what we manage to do in terms of reducing our use of fossil fuels, etc., and how we adapt to a new form of economy where we use less resources. But in terms of the evidence that we've got from our analysis, yes, it's showing that particularly with precipitation, it has accelerated probably more than we were expecting. From the climate science perspective, we always knew that there was going to be large amounts of variability in the future climate. And that's another sort of key finding from our work, is that variability is increasing. So the fact that we might have some springs in the future, which are actually really good for agriculture, for a whole range of different land uses, is a potential benefit. But then conversely, in other years, we may have particularly dry springs, which obviously will cause a lot of problems in terms of crop establishment and crop growth. So it's coping with that sort of mixed bag of responses and that increasing variability that our analysis has shown and is likely to continue in the future.
Now, the research was commissioned by the Scottish Government. How do you expect the information to be used?
Well, I know already that it's been passed through various different departments within the Scottish Government, and that they're taking it seriously. They have taken a look at the whole issue to do with the peatland restoration work and the ability to re-wet peatlands to keep carbon in the soils. They are looking at it in terms of potential need for increasing resilience in the agricultural support schemes for farmers, so that resilience becomes an essential part of how farmers are supported in terms of payment schemes. So I think across the board, they're also looking at issues to do with transport infrastructure, health. So I think the information has been taken on board and is being used across a range of different departments within Scottish Government.
There must be quite a challenge for policymakers in terms of trying to work out how to deal with trend changes, for example, what might happen to a peat landscape over time, and then dealing with the variability of the weather. So you have a good year or a bad year. And of course, this year has been very bad in terms of flooding.
Yes, I think that's going to be a real problem, not just for Scottish Government, for governments all around the world, really, is just how do they develop policies that can help mitigate climate change by reducing our use of fossil fuels, etc., but also adapting to a range of different climate impacts. For example, the impacts on the food system in the UK may be actually due to climate change impacts in other parts of the world. And we've seen that in the past. So that can lead to, say, breadbasket reductions, you know, just a relatively small amount, but that has a price spike in the cost of food. And that will have repercussions on farm level sort of management decisions about, you know, how best to sort of grow crops and what resources to use. So Scotland can't be seen in isolation in terms of what the climate change impacts are here, but in terms of how the Scottish government can respond to that variability. Yes, I think it is a really, really big challenge of how you can develop approaches and policies and economies that are able to cope with that increasing variability and volatility because of impacts elsewhere in the world.
If land managers are looking at your report and seeking guidance, what are the particular issues that you think that farmers should be aware of and indeed adapt for?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is the excess winter rainfall, and I think we've sort of seen that due to Storm Babette and subsequent storms in some areas, Angus areas, seriously flooded agricultural land, soils at saturation point for long periods of time. So it's coping with the excess of water over the winter, and then conversely, and through the spring and through the summer, it's potentially the shortage or the scarcity of water. And as I said before, we might have some years in the future where we have really good growing conditions, bumper harvests. That is a distinct possibility. But conversely, we may also have more extreme weather events that can cause a lot of problems and potential reductions in crop yield due to water scarcity at the wrong time of growth. So in terms of farmers then sort of trying to build resilience, it's how they might manage their soils to try and retain water in the soils as best they can. So it's going to be a bit of a balancing act between making sure that soils aren't saturated for too long, but at the same time, maintaining that water in the soils for as long as possible in case there are drought occurrences. So looking at how they will manage water within farms, I think it's going to be one of the key issues in the next couple of decades.
Now, nature-based carbon storage is a key tactic for emissions reduction. How should land managers reflect on the issues raised in your report in order to maximise the longevity of land-based carbon storage?
Our report shows that water availability will be a key consideration in the future, and in respect of peatlands and peatland restoration to try and keep carbon in the soils rather than it becoming a carbon dioxide release due to degradation. Rewetting is how we approach peatland restoration, so making sure there's water available. For the western areas of Scotland, I really don't think that's going to be a particular issue for most years in the future, but central and eastern areas of Scotland in the future may experience increased water scarcity, particularly in the spring and the summer. And that's due to reduced precipitation, but also increased evapotranspiration where water will leave surfaces. Some areas of the uplands in the east may have some water scarcity, which will make peatland restoration a bit more challenging. But when we come down to the more lowland areas, I think one of the first things that farmers can look to do is increasing the amount of organic matter in the soils, because that helps with water retention, and that will give some resilience to periods when there are water is scarce.
Now, as you mentioned, the report focuses on peatland carbon storage, but of course, treescapes are also vulnerable to water variability and to disease migration.
Yeah, I think the whole issue with climate change raises a lot of these sort of questions, and there are still quite a few sort of unknowns as to what will the consequences will be in terms of the risks to, say, forestry or agroforestry. I think one of the concerns is the increased level of storms and the intensity of storms and high winds. We saw with Storm Arwen the damage that did, and those sort of storms are going to become more likely. Likewise, changes in the sort of microclimates within forested areas may facilitate increased pests activities. And I think there is a lot of concern in terms of overall plant health due to invasive pests, and trying to identify where they might start to occur in the country. But I think those issues are going to become more and more serious as time goes by. Our report specifically looked at the issues to do with the climate itself, and then we made some interpretations of what that means. So I think from our report, we can look through it and start to identify where there may be sort of areas of greater vulnerability. And I think, again, for forestry, wind is obviously a big issue. And I think that then relates to the wider issues of land use management of identifying where particular activities are best suited. And one of the concerns is establishment of trees on soils that are already high in carbon, and that they actually may be better placed in areas of lower carbon, but they tend to also sometimes be shallower soils. So it's trying to match the requirements for multiple objectives, for example, carbon sequestration through tree planting, with what the soils and the soil water and what the capabilities are, and then integrating that with a mix of all the other things we're expecting to use land for. So I think in the future, well, as from now, we've got some really interesting challenges about how we achieve those sort of multiple objectives from land use. But certainly climate change itself is adding an additional level of complexity to it, because of the additional risks, be it from increased winds or reduced water availability or the prevalence of pests and diseases.
That was Dr. Mike Rivington bringing us to the end of the programme. I hope you've enjoyed the conversations. I'd like to thank all my guests. And if you can, please do take a moment to share our content and do get in touch if you've got news to share. More, as ever, on our website, 8point9.com. I've been Finlow Costain. Bye for now.